Hello, fellow rebel capitalists. Hope you're well. Sorry, we're a little bit late here. I was having some problems with my audio, so hopefully it's working well. I'll try to keep the mic right next to my face. And Josh, let me know if you've got some problems with the audio on your end. And we've got my good friend Joseph Wang back today. He is at FedGuy12 on Twitter.
Yeah.
And for those of you who don't know Joseph, Joseph, you want to give your quick backstory?
Yeah, so I used to be a senior trader on the open markets desk. I basically studied how the financial system worked and ran a bunch of Fed operations. So that's like basically when the Fed trades, they have a trading desk. And people like me, we man it.
there you go. So nobody understands kind of the Fed, quote unquote, money printing or quantitative easing or quantitative tightening as well as Joseph. So I wanted to get him on today to really discuss this topic because this is, I don't know that there's anything that's more misunderstood than how dollars are actually created in the real economy. So what I want to do is I want to start by defining some terms. So in this conversation, when we're talking about quote unquote money printing, let's focus on the dollars that are on the non-bank entities balance sheet in the real economy. Because when people really think about, you know, quote unquote money printing, they really think there's that's more dollars chasing goods and services. And so I think that's, we need to define that term first and foremost. So what most people are led to believe is that when the Fed does quantitative easing, that in and of itself is money printing. That in and of itself is going to create more dollars on the balance sheet of non-bank entities, whether it's now or within the next 2 or 3 years. At some point, it's going to happen because there's an actual increase in not just the monetary base, but it's going to result in an increase in broad money. So what are your views there? And my guess is we're going to get into some serious nuance here, which I'm excited about.
Well, first of all, it's great to be back. Love talking about this and be on the show. So I think, so I would actually step back and broaden that definition just slightly. So when we talk about non-banks and dollars, people normally think about bank deposits, right? What you have in the bank. But I would broaden that a little bit more to include also treasury securities as dollars, right? So for a lot of people, especially if you're an institutional investor, you don't really hold all your wealth in deposits at JPM or Citibank or something like that. You hold them in something that's more safer. It's credit risk-free and also very liquid. So that's treasury securities. So for non-banks, then I would say just, you know, the non-bank population, investors, me, you, retail, dollars aren't just bank deposits, but also treasuries as well. So when the Fed is doing something like quantitative easing, I don't think so much that they're increasing the quantity of dollars, but mostly changing the composition of dollars. So non-banks, like everyone, like me, you, investors, hold fewer treasuries, but more bank deposits. But if you want to focus narrowly on what M2 is, so that's broad money, that's just bank deposits. And so when the Fed is buying a lot of treasuries, they're paying with reserves that they print out of thin air. But the reserves, though, like me and you, non-banks, we don't have reserve accounts. So if I sell a treasury that gets bought by the Fed, I can't hold reserves. My bank holds it for me and credits me something in my checking account. So at the end of the day, bank deposits increase. It's a direct consequence of QE. And you can see that very clearly in the past 2 years.
So let me make sure people are following you here, because where we're going with this is it depends who is selling the treasury.
Yeah.
So if the treasury that's purchased by the Fed is, if the seller is a bank, then that is not going to increase M2.
That's correct.
If it's an individual, a non-bank entity, then it is true. It is going to increase M2.
Yes.
So my argument there is that you can't just blanket say that quantitative easing is money printing, because it depends. It depends who are they actually buying from. You say, oh, George, you're splitting hairs. No, I'm not. No, I'm not. Because most people's view is that if the Fed takes their balance sheet from $4 trillion to $8 trillion, as an example. If they expand their balance sheet, then it has to result in the CPI at some point in time going up. And if they don't understand the nuance, then that's a mistake. They need to take it two or three steps further to really have an educated view so they can determine the probabilities of CPI actually going up in the future.
I think you're exactly right. I mean, you don't even have to look at the US. You can look at Japan. You can look at the Eurozone. They've been doing quantitative easing, like Japan, for example, quantitative easing to a much larger extent than the US. The Bank of Japan basically owns almost the entire bond market, right? And you still can't get inflation there. So obviously quantitative easing itself does not cause inflation. It could have some inflationary impacts. For example, if you lower interest rates, let's say if you lower the 10-year a lot, maybe a lot of people will buy more houses, right? Stronger demand for houses pushes house prices up. That's real economy inflation. So it definitely have to be more nuanced. I think that in practice, what's been happening the past 2 years, and this isn't always going to happen, sometimes maybe banks will sell treasuries to the Fed, but in the past 2 years, at least, banks have been buying a lot of treasuries alongside the Fed. So the people who have been selling...
And keeping them on their balance sheet or just to sell to the Fed?
Keep them on their balance sheet. Okay. Banks have bought enormous amounts of treasuries the past 2 years. So if you want to look at it, there's on Fred, there's a chart there that shows it. So agency MBS and treasuries together, they've bought about one point something trillion the past 2 years. So it's a lot. So banks are buyers of treasuries alongside the Fed. So in the past 2 years, the people who've been selling are not banks. Selling to the Fed are not banks.
So how does that process work? Because I know, or correct me if I'm wrong, the Fed can't directly buy from a non-bank. Yep. I believe they can in the UK. I think they can. I think they can buy from pensions, even if the pension doesn't have an account with the Bank of England. But here, I think the Fed has to buy from a bank and or primary dealer. So would that mean that the primary dealers are having to go out into the real economy or into the non-bank entities, buy those treasuries to flip them to the Fed in addition to them expanding the amount of treasuries that they're keeping on their balance sheet?
So I would make a distinction. There's actually two separate entities. There's a primary dealer and there's a bank, and these are different entities. So if you have a big bank like JP Morgan, JP Morgan is going to own a primary dealer, but it's a separate business, separate legal entity from its bank. So you're exactly right. So the Fed only deals with primary dealers. There's 23, 24 of them. I think there's a new one. So that, in my view, doesn't really change the analysis. It's for example, let's say you go buy a stock, you ask Fidelity to buy it for me, right? Fidelity goes and, you know, is your broker basically, right? So ultimately you're buying it from someone who else is selling it, and Fidelity is kind of just like the middleman. So if you're selling a treasury, what happens is that you have to call up a dealer. There's no exchange, there's no anything. So if I'm an institutional investor, I have $1 billion in treasuries I have to sell, I call up my dealer and I ask my dealer to make a market for me. And if I don't like the price, I'll call another dealer. Eventually, I'll sell the treasury to the dealer and the dealer just takes it. And assuming that it sells it to the Fed, then it just sells it to the Fed. And then the money just goes from the Fed through the dealer to me. My bank holds reserves and I hold deposits. So they're just the dealer, primary dealers are just middlemen. I wouldn't really emphasize too much about their role. It's true that the Fed only trades with them, but it doesn't really, in my view, change the analysis.
Yeah. So let's take it a step back here, because again, this I think basic view is that the Fed can direct, like they've got a dial almost, that they can directly determine how many dollars are circulating in the real economy, or let's just say M2. You know, and I know, and I don't like that measurement. I know it's very, it's way too generic, and it doesn't, it doesn't encapture everything. But let's just use that as a proxy.
There used to be like M3, and they axed that, and they've been changing, like toying around with their money statistics. It's really, it's a hard measure because
it is almost literally impossible to even quantify exactly. Money. But just using that, just because that's kind of what everyone else references. You know, that's what they believe, is that there is this multiplier effect. So if the Fed increases their balance sheet by $1 trillion, then that has to create at least $10 trillion, I guess, if you want to go back to a 10% reserve requirement, of broad money, you know, somehow. And if that doesn't go directly into M2, well, then that somehow circulates in a roundabout way and goes into stocks or something like that. And this is what I really, really disagree with. And now I'm open to being wrong, of course, but what is your view on that? Is there just this this set in stone multiplier effect where base money always equals a certain amount of broad money?
No, that's not how the world works. And the Fed used to believe that. That's true. Those are, I think that view of thought is called the monetarist view. And, you know, you can talk about people like Milton Friedman, for example. They would think that, you know, if we change toggle broad money, it'll multiply through the economy, and that changes the money supply, and that feeds through growth and inflation. So that view was not successful. And one of the reasons is that, I mean, banks can easily evade regulations like reserve requirements by simply moving their business offshore where they don't really have reserve requirements. So that way of thinking was not effective. The Fed moved to thinking about money, controlling the money supply, more in terms of price, so interest rates. So they know that they really can't control the quantity through reserve requirements and the quantity of reserves, but they have some influence over interest rates. So for example, if the Fed were to raise interest rates to 20%, then there would be less demand for credit, so banks will make fewer loans. And so that kind of dampens down the money supply in that sense.
Even that's nuanced, Joseph. I'm sorry for cutting you off there, but I don't know that that's always true.
No, it's not always true.
And this may be taking it to too far of an extreme, but that's how I kind of understand things in my own mind. So let's just say that right now, interest rates, let's just say mortgages is 5%. Yep. But let's say everyone's balance sheet is completely levered up and there's just no credit or very few credit worthy people out there. So therefore, or the banks don't see good risk reward at 5%. And therefore there's not going to be much lending, even if the interest rates are low, where we could be in an environment where banks do see good risk reward at 20%, and there's actually going to be more lending, therefore more dollars created. So it's my point there is it's about the interest rate for sure, but it's not just about the interest rate. It's about the bank's willingness to lend, and then also there being creditworthy borrowers to lend to.
100%. And that, I think, is why the central banks have been not doing a good job in the past 10 years. They think that if you lower interest rates, somehow things are supposed to get back to normal. You're supposed to have a lot of lending and borrowing. But it's not just about the price of money, especially when it's already so cheap. It has to do with expectations of demand, you know, the financial conditions. Maybe they're already too levered. So I think that really that's really important. And part of the reason why post GFC we have had such slow growth rates, especially since money was so cheap. So definitely interest rates are not enough. That's where the fiscal spending comes in, right? No one wants to borrow and spend. The government would do it. So that's what's different this time around. You have the government just insanely just expanding their borrowing spending. So that's what's changed this time around.
Right. So just let me try to summarize where we are so far here, so everyone's on the same page, and correct me if I'm wrong. But if first and foremost, the banks, when they create a new loan, they are printing money. That we can say definitively. Yep. Yep. And then when the Fed expands their balance sheet, we can say that if those treasuries that they're buying or mortgage-backed securities are being purchased through the primary dealer from a non-bank entity in the real economy, then it is going to increase, all else being equal, it's going to increase M2 money supply, or that broad money.
Absolutely.
If the Fed is expanding their balance sheet and those primary dealers are buying from a bank entity, then it isn't necessarily going to expand broad money because they're using base money to pay for that transactions, i.e.
Yes.
bank reserves denominated in dollars. So exactly. There's a lot of nuance there. So it's not just if the Fed does this, then this happens to broad money. It all depends. Therefore, to me, you can't just say if the Fed increases their balance sheet, that in and of itself is money printing.
Yes.
Now, moving on, if the government deficit spends and they're not selling those bonds directly to the non-bank entities in the real economy, or if they're not taxing those dollars, then the Fed is purchasing those with new bank reserves denominated in dollars. Then when the TGA or when the Treasury spends that money back into the real economy, then that is also going to increase broad money or M2. And yes. that would be money printing. But again, it's not the Fed doing it by themselves. The Fed has to have the willingness of the government, or they have to have the willingness of the banks, or the primary dealers have to choose to buy treasuries or mortgage-backed securities from non-bank entities for the expansion of the balance sheet to also equal an expansion of broad money.
Except the primary dealer part. The primary dealers, they don't choose. They have clients. They buy everyone. So every day, $600 billion in cash treasuries every single day. So you can just think about the Fed as one more participant in that giant market. So
so how do they determine?
I guess who sells it? Yeah,
right,
it's the clients who sell it. Yeah. So
it's just who's ever willing to sell at the time.
They don't care who they're buying.
Right. Okay, so they're not choosing. They're just, it's just whomever wants to sell. So if all the banks are selling, then it's not going to increase M2. If everyone that day just happens to be a non-bank that wants to sell their treasuries, then it's going to go ahead and increase M2 yes. or broad money.
Yes.
Okay, so it's completely haphazard. And again, the Fed doesn't control that.
Does not, no.
Okay, so...
It does have influence over it. Just not complete influence.
Yeah. How did this... the system right now is just completely flushed with reserves. And I've been telling people that, in my opinion, really the banks don't need your deposits anymore like they did prior to the GFC. That's probably why you're seeing such terrible customers.
They're telling their big customers we don't really want your deposits. It's not good for them. So if you're like an institutional money manager and you want to deposit it in a bank, they don't want your money because it's bad for their regulatory metrics. So under the regulatory metrics, deposits have different grades. Now the ones that come from institutional deposits, those are viewed as flighty. Because if something happens, they're going to withdraw their money. So that's going to put strain on their liquidity. And so from a regulatory standpoint, those deposits are costly. They're negative to the bank. So they don't want them. So that's why you have a lot of big institutional investors in money market funds, because the banks don't want to hold their money.
And what, just if someone were to rewind and listen to the last 10 or 15 minutes of our conversation, would that explain why there is very little correlation between the Fed's balance sheet, more specifically the amount of bank reserves on their balance sheet, and M2?
That plays a role, for example, because that means all the reserves are basically flowing down into the RRP facility, right? So when the Fed is expanding its balance sheet, instead of the money going to the banking sector where it would be balanced by a deposit liability, then a lot of it is flowing into the RRP. So there's no deposit liability balance there. It's balanced by, a share in the money market fund. But overall,
okay, I don't think I articulated my question very well. Let me pull up a chart here. This is one of the charts I've been using to just kind of, in my own mind, there's just no way that the Fed, their balance sheet, or at least the amount of bank reserves, can directly influence M2, right, all the time, to where it's just a rule that's written in stone. So, this is the, go ahead.
So there's a, if you're looking at the GFC world, there's one nuance that you have to keep in mind there. So post-GFC, right in the aftermath of the GFC, a lot of loans were being repaid. So money was being destroyed as a lot of people were repaying down their loans.
Right.
In the absence of the Fed's QE, you would have seen broad money supply shrink. But because of QE, you saw it continue to grow on trend line. Since you've pulled up this Fred chart, the way that you could see that is you can look at bank credit creation, banks.
You want me to pull up another chart of that?
Let me make sure.
I should expand. This is just the reason I did this, Joseph, is just because it's from 1990.
Okay. Well,
2008. Well,
back then, that's 50 billion is not a lot in the banking system. So it depends on a lot of factors for sure. But you won't really see it unless you pull it to extremes. And so the extremes happened during COVID, right? The Fed basically went insane with their money printer.
Let me do this. Here we go.
Yes, that there. And then you can pull up M2 or bank deposits or deposits at banks.
Let's do M2.
Okay. So the scale is different, but if you look at, there you go. See, that's the Fed's influence there. Now, it's not the only thing that matters.
That would be the Fed's influence. Now, let me ask you this. Would we have seen this jump in M2 if the government would not have deficit spent?
So wait, say that again. So
yeah, let's just assume, because right here, you know, this is March 2020. Can you see the date there on the chart?
Yes.
Okay. So this is right, we'll call it the Cerveza sickness right here. And this is right when we start getting them announcing the CARES Act, right?
Yes.
So let's just say that for round numbers here, that the government deficit spend about $5 trillion in 2020, probably $3 trillion, something like that in 2021, and a lot of that was monetized by the Fed. So as we were saying earlier, that is going to increase M2 money supply.
Yes.
But my question is, if let's say the deficit during
2020 I understand.
Would have if been you did zero. Not,
if they didn't, I understand what you're saying. Actually, yes, it would be. So basically quantitative.
We probably would have seen a decline actually. Because bank lending, I think, went down substantially.
No. Bank lending, so part of that is actually bank lending that you see there. So
but that's PPP. I'm sorry. So I'm sorry, Joseph. The chart I remember where bank lending went down was after PPP.
Okay. I think what you're talking about is as the PPE loans get repaid, then it looks like the loans declined because they're getting repaid from the government. So the PPP loans are loans on the bank's balance sheet, but as they get forgiven, then those loans decline, and so it looks like the banks are shrinking their loan portfolio. The immediate aftermath of the Cerveza sickness, there was a tremendous squeeze, a surge in bank lending, that was all these corporations basically drawing down their emergency revolving credit lines. They're like, the world is the world is going to end, and I need cash now. And so you actually see a very big spike. So you see this now?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that's commercial industrial loans. And you can see this here.
See
that?
That's the one I use in my presentation.
So I was on the desk then, and everyone was telling us is that the world is going to end. So I drew down on my court revolver. And so that's what you see there.
From personal experience.
So, and you can see, and some of that is also the PPP as well. It's a little bit earlier for the PPP. So anyway, gradually they declined as they got repaid because the world was not going to end and everything was okay.
But then that should influence M2, because if they're drawing on their credit lines, then that's going to increase M2.
Exactly. And that's part of the big spike that you see.
Okay, perfect. So just what I was pointing out with the M2 here, we don't even have to zoom in, if you go back to 90 to 2008, bank reserves declined, but yet M2 went from, I think, 3 trillion up to 8 trillion. Hey guys, I want to remind you to get your tickets to Rebel Capitalist Live, This is the live conference I do twice per year with all of your favorite speakers from the Rebel Capitalist Show and experts in investing, commodities, real estate, freedom, and liberty. All of your favorite topics, all of your favorite speakers. The next Rebel Capitalist Live is going to be in Miami, and tickets increase in price as we get closer to the event. So go to rebelcapitalistlive.com right now to get your tickets to the next Rebel Capitalist Live. It's the conference you cannot afford to miss. It'll help you increase your financial freedom and, more importantly, your personal freedom. You'll get intel that you won't hear anywhere else. Past speakers have included icons in macroeconomics, investing, and personal freedom and liberty. People like Dr. Ron Paul, Robert Kiyosaki, Brent Johnson, Lynn Alden, Jeff Snyder, Richard Werner, Mark Moss, Lynette Zhang, and Robert Breedlove, just to name a few. So once again, go to Rebel Capitalist Live right now and get your tickets today. You know, another thing that I found interesting that is a little bit off topic, but now that I've got you on live here, I'd love to get your opinion on this. I stumbled across this chart yesterday when I was just kind of browsing around on a Sunday morning. And this is one of the best charts I've ever seen in my life. Let me, Josh.
Oh, I got to see that then.
Yeah. And this is from this website that I hadn't even heard of. It's called investmentoffice.com. And this is a visual history of the Federal Reserve System from 1914 to 2009. So if you go down, I already clicked on it. If you click on the link, it takes you to this PDF. And the amount of data in this chart, and it goes from 1950, it goes from left to right, and then it shows the assets and the liabilities, and then it goes from right to left in chronological order, and it gives you, they've got CPI in here, they've got Fed funds, and then if you go over here, they've got summaries of what happened during this time frame, like the major points of reference. And then they've got a legend. All of this data is on this chart.
Wow, that's an awesome chart. I can't imagine. This is
so much crazy.
So much work had to go into this.
Yeah, and so what I found really interesting here is this goes back. Now we're kind of switching topics, viewers. And we'll go back to money printing with the Fed. But this goes back to the whiteboard video that we were discussing before we, I think, hit the live button. And I was talking about how inflation, I've never seen it go up in a straight line. And the pushback I get on that, is people get hyper-focused on the 70s, and they say, well, that's because during the times when inflation came down throughout the 70s, the Fed was able to take real rates positive. And there's just no way that they could do that today because of the debt and a lot of other things. And so, therefore, inflation has to go from 7.5 and just kind of this nonstop 9 to 14 to 18 to 25 to 40. And inflation will never stop going up. It won't even take a breather because the Fed can't create positive real rates. But I looked at the 1940s and I found it fascinating that the Fed actually from the call it 1942-ish, 1943, to 1946, they increased their balance sheet by almost 100%. And, this is obviously because of World War II. And then, they pegged the curve back then, and they had the curve pegged to a max rate on the long bond of 2.5%. And they didn't get rid of that that yield curve control, if you will, until 1951. And so what I found fascinating is that inflation, the CPI in 1947 was 19.5%, just a staggering amount.
Wow.
But it went all the way down in 1949 to negative 2.9%. So 2.9% deflation. And the Fed obviously did nothing. That this was not a result of the Fed. In fact, if anything, the Fed was exacerbating the inflation because they had the yield curve pegged. So my pushback is that it's not all the Fed doesn't always have to create positive real rates on Fed funds to bring inflation down. Sometimes it just happens. Now, I'm not saying that what we're living through today is exactly like the 1940s. It's just showing that positive real rates aren't always a necessary prerequisite to inflation coming down slightly before it goes back up, or which it did here when we started the Korean War. Another thought that I had that I'd love to get your ideas on is, and I think I've heard Snyder say this a few times, where he was talking about yield curve control and that it didn't really matter that much. And when he first said that, I'm like, how can that work? But it's actually, if you look at the Fed's balance sheet from 46 to 51, it didn't even increase. I mean, you had a time there where it kind of went up, and this would imply that they didn't have to buy bonds in order to keep the yield pegged, that the market would have done it naturally while we had CPI at 19.5%. What am I crazy, or do you think there's some value in these data points here?
No, I think this is super interesting, and you're definitely right. I mean, inflation, the Fed has influence of it, but not control over it. So they're just one factor among others, and sometimes not even the most important factor. Sometimes, you know, if you're the Fed and you credibly say that, you know, I'm going to peg it this way, the market won't challenge you. And so you don't actually have to do your huge operations because they know that, you know, they know that you're good for it.
Maybe this is when the Fed, it first dawned on them that the psychological influence they have over markets, and maybe this is when expectation policy, like the genesis of expectations policy.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I don't. And also I tend to think that the Fed has a lot more power over the financial economy than the real economy. So I think the Fed can do just about anything in the financial economy, but the real economy.
So explain that a little bit further, because another pushback that I get or another argument that I think is valid is they say, well, okay, even if the Fed doesn't directly influence broad money, that by expanding the balance sheet, they expand the balance sheet capacity of the commercial banks. If the commercial banks don't create consumer loans, therefore increase broad money, they're doing something that allow hedge funds to go in and buy up stocks. Therefore, we're not seeing the price inflation in the real economy. We're seeing it in asset prices. My pushback there is always, okay, well, if we've seen the inflation in asset prices, if asset prices come down, how do you expect the CPI to go from 7.5 to 15%? But that's a completely separate rabbit hole. So what do you think about that idea of the Fed? There has to be inflation somewhere, and we've just seen it in asset prices because of the expansion of the Fed balance sheet.
So I think of quantitative easing as not increasing the quantity of money, just the composition of it. So because treasuries are just money that pays interest, the Fed doesn't actually increase the quantity, just the composition. The composition matters a lot, though, because treasuries pay interest and they're risk-free. You have a whole class of investors who can't take credit risk and who need a little bit of return. And so on a macro level, when you take out treasuries and increase and replace them with bank deposits, you're squeezing a lot of investors to go and buy longer dated treasuries, buy Apple bonds, buy maybe even Apple stock. And that's where the inflation comes in. And that is actually the intention of quantitative easing. It's the wealth effect. So that works. It works pretty well, I think.
To push people out the risk curve.
Yes, exactly. Listen, if the Fed were to say, I'm going to do quantitative easing, $1 trillion a month, you know, stocks would go to the moon, right? So everyone in the market understands QE is good for risk assets. I think that's the mechanics behind it. But really, just by saying it, everyone believes it anyway. Now, just going back to your point about bank lending, though, the thing about QE, though, is that it actually takes up space on a bank's balance sheet, the reserves. So under regulations, banks have just so much space on their balance sheet. You know, it's like a department store. It has so much square footage. They can put loans to commercial, to real economy people in that space, or they can put reserves in that space, right? So some people think that if you do lots of quantitative easing, you fill that department store up with bank reserves, so there's less space for commercial loans. Now, that might not be true, but that is something to think about as well. So because, you know, there's only so much space on a bank's balance sheet. Usually, though, a bank has control over that, so they can push out some money that they don't want, like I was mentioning earlier, make them go into money funds to make space for loans. So it's not necessarily super binding. But
interesting. I always thought that if they had more reserves, that in and of itself would always increase their balance sheet capacity. Not that they would use it, but it would increase it.
No, it takes up space. So balance sheet capacity is a function of your capital, right? Let's say you have $1 billion in capital. Say that gives you $20 billion in balance sheet capacity under the leverage ratio. Leverage ratio is unweighted. If you pump the system full of reserves, well, that's reserves are going to take up some of that space.
I see.
The good thing, though, is that there's a way to get rid of those reserves. The bank just has to go to its client and say, get out and go to my money market fund. And then all those reserves flow to the RRP. The bank has more space to make loans to the real economy. Maybe it costs the relationship a little bit. That's a case-by-case basis.
Yeah, so that's fascinating. Guys, so you're following what Joseph is saying there. If the Fed has a reverse repo facility that is a liability on their balance sheet, just like the bank reserve accounts and just like the TGA. So if the banks are getting too many bank reserves, that's taking up balance sheet space that they would prefer to be taken up by actual productive loans, then they could encourage their clients to go into a money market fund. So if those clients choose to do that, then the Fed would take those bank reserves from the reserve account of the bank and move it down into the reverse repo account. So the Fed's balance sheet would not change in size. It would just change where, maybe the composition is a good way to say that. It would just change from the bank reserve accounts of the banks down to that a reverse repo account.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
Yeah, that's really interesting. So in a sense that quantitative easing could decrease, and again, not directly, but indirectly decrease the amount of bank lending because they don't have enough balance sheet capacity for both.
Exactly. Or in theory, let's just say in theory, maybe IOR goes super high. Maybe it makes more sense to hold IOR risk-free reserves at deposits at the Fed than it is to make loans, right? So no, we've never gotten there yet, so I don't know if that's going to happen. I suspect that if IOR really got, let's say, to 5%, private sector loans would still yield a lot more. So I don't know. But yeah, it takes up space, and you only have so much space. You're like a bank is like a department store with only so much floor space.
Was that applicable prior, or maybe applicable to the same degree prior to Basel III?
No, Basel III changed everything. But listen, so Basel III is trying to end too big to fail, right? So the bigger you get, the steeper the leverage ratio charges are. So a big bank so this ratio is called the leverage ratio. Pre-Basel III, you had an FDIC leverage ratio of 4% flat. Basel III changes that in a bit. It has something called the SLR, supplementary leverage ratio. So it's calculated in a way so that it's both broader, so the capital charges are higher, but also it's increasing in the size of the bank. It's meant to end too big to fail. So the big banks are basically have higher cost of capital because of it.
Is there a way for the banks to get around that the same way they used to get around the reserve requirement? 10% reserve requirement?
No, this is really hard to get. Oh, well, yeah. Well, they could just, you know, issue more. So the answer is no, but there are ways that they can optimize it. So they can issue more stock, issue more preferred stock and so forth, just have more equity. I think of this banking system as basically the last war. The regulations are so rigorous that they've quasi-socialized the banks.
Right.
I don't ever worry about banks failing. Or an easy way to see this is like, let's say the surveys of sickness, pandemonium in markets, nothing wrong with the banks, nothing at all. So that's a very good stress test, and they've passed with flying colors.
Yeah. So is it true to say that prior to Basel III, let's just go back to prior to the GFC, that the more reserves a bank had, that would actually directly impact their balance sheet capacity? But now that we have this new system, first with IOR and then quantitative easing, and then with Basel III, then that may or may not be true.
So reserves are an asset on the bank's balance sheet, whereas the leverage ratio is more about a capital constraint. So capital is a liability. So if you have enough capital, you can have a very big balance sheet, right? So if you had $1 billion pre-GFC, you could have a very, very big balance sheet, assuming that. But post-GFC, you could have your $1 billion capital gives you a smaller balance sheet. That's the difference. Now, that's the U.S. In the Eurozone, pre-GFC, balance sheet was basically infinite. Like, they didn't really have a leverage ratio the same way.
In the whole Eurodollar market, right?
European banks, not European. So that does play a role as well. So yeah. Pre-GFC, the European banks had a much, much looser leverage ratio than U.S. banks. So they just expanded it like enormously. And a lot of it was to do Eurodollar trades. So what they would do, they would borrow from the U.S. dollar money market funds, borrow like $1 trillion or something like that, take that money and invest in mortgage-related assets. So all this is basically booked out of their headquarters in Euroland, let's say Frankfurt or Paris or something like that. And so that was all offshore dollars. But, you know, technically it's U.S. investors and U.S. assets. So it's more of a regulatory arbitrage. But they were able to do huge trades like that because the leverage ratio wasn't really binding. And so if you don't have much of a leverage ratio, you can lever up enormously and you can make a lot of money. Let's say you borrow at 2% and you lend at 4%. Doesn't sound like a lot, but what if you lever it up to doing like, you know, $100 billion of that, then that adds up.
That's interesting. So that regulatory hurdle, let's say, is a way, if I'm thinking about it correctly, to kind of cap money printing as we know it from the banking system.
Yes. For a single bank, you could have multiple banks though, right? Then you can get around it. And that's intention though, right? If you get a bank so big that they might fail, if they fail, they'll take everyone down with them. So they don't want a single bank to be too big, and that does cap their money printing ability as well.
All right. And I guess, you know, one question that I get all the time on people who are really trying to sort this out is, okay, George, if banks print money and if they're the main source of quote unquote money printing, absent the central planners, you know, the government spending, deficit spending, whatnot, why don't the banks just lend each other $1 billion and just be rich? Why would that not work, or would it work? Is the only constraint just counterparty risk? And now I'm talking about maybe in the euro dollar system where the banks are far less regulated.
So I guess your example would be, what if there's just one bank in the entire world? Can't they just print infinite amounts of money and just get rich, right?
Yeah, my answer there would be yes.
So the thing is that the deposits that they create, they can never have they have to be able to back that with sovereign money, right? Let's say you go and you withdraw all your money from the bank and you ask for a currency instead. That's something they can't print. So that there is that one constraint there. In terms of banks just lending to each other, Basel III doesn't like that. So in the pre-GFC world, banks did that all the time, very, very tight interbank market. So you can think of them as almost acting as if they're one bank, because if one bank is out of money, they can always borrow from someone else. Right. So the more interbank activity you have, the more that these multiple banks converge as if they were acting as if they were one bank, because they're all tightly knit together. But that's not how the market is anymore. The Basel II broke those connections. The reason being that during the GFC, one of the banks had went bust, and that took everyone down with them. So they don't want that to happen anymore. I would push back a bit about this unregulated bank stuff. The thing about the euro dollar market, it's vast and it's large, but the people who run the euro dollar market are the same big banks that we see and know and see, and they're all under Basel III, which is the global standard. So who makes dollar loans abroad? The same big banks that everyone knows. You got the BNPs, the Soc-Chins, the Barclays, and you got the Japanese banks and so forth. Those are the banks. So to have an offshore dollar business, you have to be a big bank because you don't have the scale or the resources otherwise. It's not a local bank. Well, they do that, but they're not big. So it's all the global banks that we know, and they all run under Basel III. So the regulatory net is very much global.
So this gives me a great opportunity to plug your upcoming conversation with our good friend Jeff Snyder, because I know he may just push back on that a little bit. So can you tell us when you're going to be talking to Jeff? Because I'm extremely excited to listen to that conversation.
Yeah, so I look forward to meeting Jeff. I mean, smart guy, does a lot of great work. I look forward to speaking with him in March 8th. It's going to be with Jack Farley on Blockworks.
Blockworks, okay, cool. So guys, put that in your calendar. Right now, I'll probably retweet it and do all that stuff because I think it's going to be extremely important for people to listen to that. All right, so one more thing here before you go, and I know I've taken up a lot of your time, so I really appreciate it. And I'm sure I'm going to make myself look incredibly foolish here, but I really don't care. I do that all the time, Joseph.
We all do that all the time.
So let me go over to my email, and can you see this, my scribblings here?
Yes.
This is actually, so guys, just FYI, what's going on? When I'm trying to think through a whiteboard video, I actually use the whiteboard. And so you guys see when I write up on the whiteboard, how you can actually read my handwriting. FYI, that is not my real handwriting. Trying to draw like a first grader. Remember when you're in first grade, Joseph, and you had that paper with like the line in the middle?
Yeah. Well,
I try to draw like super slow to make the letters just perfect for your teacher. That's what I do on the whiteboard for the videos. Well, this is my real chicken scratch here.
My handwriting has not changed since third grade. So I don't mind. That's why I type all the time.
All right. So I've got Bank A. I'll try to walk you through. So in the upper left corner, I've got the balance sheet for Bank A. And then I didn't write it here, but below that, I've got the balance sheet for Bank B. And so I thought, you know, what would happen if just each bank, like what would happen to their balance sheet if each bank lent each other $1 billion and that was the only thing on their balance sheet, let's just say. And let's just say we didn't have any Basel III and all that other nonsense. So you'd have the Bank A would now have a deposit right here. That would be an asset on their balance sheet. And this deposit would be, or I'm sorry, this is a liability. So this would be the asset, the deposit. And this would also be a liability on Bank B's balance sheet. And then likewise, they would have a deposit for Bank B as a liability. And then that would be an asset of Bank B.
Yes.
And the loan that was created would be they would have to pay that back theoretically. So that would be a liability for Bank A, and that would be an asset for Bank B. And then vice versa, we'd have a loan to Bank B would be an asset on Bank A's balance sheet, and then a liability on Bank B. So then I thought to myself, okay, well, what would the balance sheet look like if these banks were just in cahoots? And they said, okay, well, let's just do this, and then we'll just cancel out the loans because I owe you money, you owe me, so let's just call it a wash. And then you've got the banks are left with just the deposits as the, there we go. So you're just left with the deposits now. So the Bank A has their deposit as their asset, and then the offsetting deposit for Bank B, And the same with Bank B. But then where it gets tricky, so this might be theoretically possible. Where it gets tricky is when you have a bank spend the money that they just received. So let's just say Bank B buys a property. Then Bank A would transfer that deposit, let's say, to a third bank that's not involved. And so then the liability would go down to zero, but they would have to transfer some sort of deposit. So they would have to transfer their deposit that was their asset to this other bank. And then they would be left with nothing, no assets, no liabilities. And then the Bank B would have the property as the asset and the deposit as the liability that would now, and here's where it gets interesting, I think, because now that deposit would be an asset of the third party bank, and still it would be a liability of Bank B. And that's where you have counterparty risk, because these two banks, they may be in cahoots, but the Bank B isn't in cahoots with Bank C. And therefore, if Bank C doesn't know who the hell Bank B is, then they're not going to want this deposit because they don't know the counterparty risk involved. So therefore, the more banks you have, the harder it would be to actually pull this off in the absence of any regulation. Am I completely off the plot here, or what do you think?
I think you're describing the market, the banking system pre-GFC. These deposits, yeah. Liabilities, these are called federal funds sold. So these are Fed funds. A Fed funds is basically an overnight loan of reserves to another bank. So you can think of it as a deposit, really. One of the ways that I heard, there's a person called Zoltan. He's a really good strategist.
Yeah,
so,
everyone on my channel knows him. I've done a bunch of whiteboard videos.
So one of the ways that Zoltan describes this, and I really like it, is that pre-GFC, banks create stored liquidity within the banking system. And so, for example, let's say the bank has, you know, liabilities that, right? Let's say deposits, but it also has to have liquid assets to meet those deposits. Pre-GFC, those liquid deposits were deposits at other banks, interbank deposits, like your graph, right? So let's say I'm Bank A. I lent Bank B money in the federal funds market. It's an overnight deposit at Bank B. I'm going to get that money back tomorrow. That's my liquid asset that I can use to meet withdrawals tomorrow. So that's how the system worked. Banking system, just because of the federal funds market, everyone had deposits with everyone. It's like the system you're describing now. And it worked, right? And really, as long as all the credit stuff is okay, it'll work. But then what happened was that one day, you know, Bank A had a deposit at Bank B, woke up the next day, realized it doesn't have a deposit at Bank B.
One day you got Bear Stearns, right?
Exactly. So what happens then? Then that means I don't have money to meet my withdrawals. Shit. And what about people who deposited money with me? Well, they have the same problem. So you have this chain reaction. So post-GFC, it was decided that banks cannot hold liquidity in another bank. They can only hold liquidity at the Fed. And so that's why everyone must hold reserves now. So that's just the structural shift. The credit risk thing was a problem then. Maybe if we had better regulation, it wouldn't be like that. I don't know. But it really is a sea change from since the GFC. Which is what you described.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much, man, for helping me kind of think through that and for this once again incredible conversation. I know everyone really appreciates your time and just loves hearing you think through all of these complex questions. So for the viewers who want to find out more about what you do or maybe buy your book, let's tell them about all the cool stuff you've got going on.
Yeah. Oh, first of all, thanks so much, George. I love talking about this stuff, and I really love this stuff too. So I appreciate, you know, finding an audience who also is interested in the banking system. So I write on FedGuy.com. I write about what's happening in the markets from a financial systems perspective. If you're interested in learning more about how the financial system works, you can check out my book, CentralBanking101.com. It's on Amazon.com. I also have a couple online courses on my website if you're interested in a deep dive into the repo market or into the Fed balance sheet.
That's awesome. Okay, so let's just kind of wrap things up in a nice, neat, tidy bow here for all the viewers. When when does the Fed print money and when does it not print money?
Prints money when a non-bank sells treasuries to the Fed, right? But if a bank is selling treasuries to the Fed, well, then the bank just, you know, swapping treasuries for reserves, bond money doesn't increase.
Right. And that's pretty much the only time that the Fed would print money. Other than that, if we do see an increase in the Fed's balance sheet and an increase in broad money, we'll say M2, it is a result of the government actually deficit spending that is we'll call it monetized by the Fed, or it's just a simple fact of it's probably doesn't have anything to do with the Fed's balance sheet, the banking system just creating more loans.
Deficit spending alone wouldn't create broad money. They'd have to be monetized by the Fed, basically, like QE. But yeah, broad money, banking system creates it.
Yeah, awesome. All right, buddy. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Yeah, well, good to see you again, George.
All right, have a good one.
Bye.